The FDA's advisory board has recommended against approval of MDMA-assisted therapy for treatment of PTSD, and there are many reasons why.
Yeah, this is an interesting one to me. Probably the biggest thing is the small number of participants, but this is kind of a stark contrast to aducanumab or any other number of monoclonal antibodies that they actually approved for dementia.
Yeah, we dive into the trials. There's not a huge number of participants, but there is certainly promising efficacy when it comes to MDMA-assisted therapy. But a lot of our concern at the end of the day stems around its comparison of efficacy to side effect ratio when compared to things like ketamine-assisted therapy.
Yeah, and to be clear, there were a lot of side effects, but not a lot of major safety signals or safety concerns.
Yeah, so for a balanced approach, if you want to listen to someone who discusses the benefits and the risks, other than I like MDMA-assisted therapy and everybody should do it, or we should never do this, stay tuned. Welcome back to the Gillette Health Podcast, where we give you tools to develop a balanced approach for health. I'm Dr. Kyle Gillette, and my co-host today is James O'Hara.
Yeah, my name is James O'Hara, and I'm a nurse practitioner. And on this podcast, we are not giving medical advice, specifically not advising anyone to take MDMA outside of clinical research settings. But today we are going to be talking about MDMA, the FDA's recent advisory panel, and the actual studies that they reviewed, looking at the outcomes, the methods, how those were conducted, and so forth. Mm-hmm.
Recently, a preliminary ruling on MDMA has come out from the FDA, and they are basically escalating this to decide, I suppose, whether or not they want to recommend for or against continued trials of MDMA. It is in the phase three of clinical trials, which means that they are, you know, if you say clinical, it means on humans. If it's preclinical, it's on animals. So the trials in this have actually accelerated pretty quickly.
Yeah, it's been around for a long time. And at this point, we're about 2 weeks away from the official decision, the time we're recording this podcast. So we'll make our predictions and maybe we're right, maybe we're wrong. The answer will probably be known by the time this comes out, but they kind of have three options. They can say, hey, this is approved, and then it becomes an FDA-approved drug you can get at a pharmacy. They can say that we are not approving this, or they can request further studies and further information.
So if this was a big pharma drug, wouldn't this already be approved? For example, if it was from Pfizer, Merck, GlaxoSmithKline, Novartis, surely it would already be approved.
Yeah, I think, was it Lykos? I may be butchering that, but I think that's the name of the company. And I don't know if they have any ex-employees who have found seats on the FDA's advisory panel. Mm. I know that some of those companies like Pfizer that you mentioned certainly have sort of this reciprocal process where they work for the companies and then they end up consulting for the FDA later on in their careers. And maybe it's totally coincidental. Maybe it doesn't influence their decisions. Maybe they are people of the utmost high moral standards. The truth is we just don't know. But I don't believe that anyone from Lykos has gone and worked for the FDA.
Yeah, maybe they should look into that. Oddly enough, this is originally a Merck product.
Yeah. It's a good callback there. This drug has been around for over 100 years. Mm-hmm. What was really interesting to me is that Merck, they did not even realize what they had when they synthesized it. I was reading an article about the history of it.
Yep.
It was only used as an intermediary product to synthesize some other medication used in hemostasis to prevent bleeding.
Yeah.
And they were only doing that to try and get around a patent that another company had. And then
even over 100 years ago, Merck was still trying to get around patents.
Yeah. And just by happenstance, they created MDMA, which sort of got rediscovered, I believe, in the 70s or 80s.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah. Oddly enough, also around 100 years ago, we would clinically use amphetamines other than Adderall, than mixed amphetamine salts. For example, Abbott used to have the clinically dosed methamphetamine, Dioxin. So for those interested, we'll link an old link to their advertisement, which included free samples for the doctor's office below.
Yeah, Abbott was marketing Desoxyn. There was a number of companies that produced methamphetamine under several brand names, and a lot of it was for hyperphagia or obesity, even you know, back in the 1950s, I believe that was.
Yeah, so not a new problem. But I guess that was right during the time that fast food and agricultural farming blew up. So there must be a direct link between those two things, obesity medications and the agriculture industry.
And the food environment.
Yep.
Yeah, interesting bit of history. So MDMA, I believe now is more commonly known as a party drug. But what is it? How does it work? Why is it something that is controversial?
Yeah. So clinically, of course, the people who were in these clinical trials were consuming pure MDMA. When it is a party drug, I believe it is essentially never just MDMA. It's always laced with other things. Not that all, you know, street drugs are not laced, but I think MDMA is notorious for that. But it is certainly serotonergic. So you think of other serotonergic compounds like psilocybin or LSD. It's kind of, it has some similar effects. And it has also a catecholamine, but oddly enough, it does affect testosterone, cortisol, and other steroid hormones for many hours after consumption.
Yeah, that was some really interesting data. Seeing a 300 nanogram per deciliter magnitude of change in testosterone level. And now this was in, recreational users who were dancing and clubbing and this sort of thing.
Yep. Exercise.
I assume there were quite a few that were lost to follow up there. It's like, do you really want to come back 2 days later when you're still coming down off your MDMA and get some blood work? But a percentage of them did, and it was only, I think, 12 people in the study. But it does appear to have a pretty significant influence, probably the most potently on raising cortisol.
Yeah.
Which sounds awfully catabolic.
Yeah. So if you're trying to just lose weight, I guess you could lose lean body mass and have more muscle protein degradation. Not great for a bodybuilder. Not great for a brain builder either.
Yeah. Yeah. And you have been talking about this for quite some time. I've seen some people pose that maybe there is a study or two out there that doesn't seem to demonstrate significant neurotoxicity, but there is what looks like an abundance of data supporting that it has some neurotoxicity. Specifically more so in the serotonergic system for humans, but more so in the dopaminergic system for the rodent models. So kind of an interesting difference that you see there. But anyway, we've linked to this nearly 200-page document, the Sci-Hub link. So do not use this URL. If you see this URL on your browser, you should know to close that, because that would be bad, because then the owners of these journals will not be able to feed their families.
Correct. Yes. They definitely receive a huge cut. Actually, I think the journal takes all of it, don't they?
The
if you
reviewers,
don't publish open access.
The reviewers are a lot of times working pro bono. You know, they're not necessarily getting paid to review articles.
Yeah.
But I think there may be a paradigm change there where now any NIH-funded or federally funded research is going to have to be open access at some point.
Good.
Which makes a lot of sense.
It should be.
Should have been done many years ago.
Yep. If I paid for it and if you paid for it, then, and you probably did help pay for it. If you're listening to this podcast, you probably pay in the 50% of people that pay taxes. But anyway, that has nothing to do with the podcast. Then it should be able to be seen. But I guess we should dive into some studies. These studies, is it like ketamine where they just, give them a dose of it and then let them sit in a room, or do they do therapy? Or what's some of the limitations of these studies?
Yeah, it's pretty intense. The same company ran a trial in 2021, 2023, basically the same design, about the same size of studies, specifically for PTSD. So I'm not intimately familiar with some of the scoring or questionnaires that they're having people fill out, but it did seem to lead to really significant improvements compared to just placebo alone.
Yep.
So it was about 50 patients in each arm. So about 50 people getting the active MDMA, 50 people getting the placebo. And there was a booster that was optional. So people are taking their first dose, 80 to 120 milligrams, and then an optional booster of 40 to 60 milligrams. hour and a half to 2.5 hours into the session. And this is an 8-hour therapy session, which is pretty intense. Mm-hmm. They had three of these sessions about a month apart.
Yes, most people took the booster dose. And yes, as you can see, the therapy-only group, even though the people who got the placebo probably knew that they got the placebo, they still did quite well.
Yeah, 8 hours of therapy. I mean, that's a lot of time to sort through feelings, trauma, emotions, and develop coping strategies. That's essentially a full day of work for a lot of people. You know, 8 hours in there is a lot you can get accomplished.
Yeah.
So not
too dissimilar to the trials for PTSD of Spravato or esketamine, and also not too dissimilar to trials of macro-dosed psilocybin. In general, the trials on psilocybin for another very serotonergic compound for depression usually are micro-dosed, whereas for PTSD are, widely spaced macro doses.
Right. So and we would tend to think that, not necessarily saying people should do this, but we would think that psilocybin would be slightly less neurotoxic.
Agreed.
Compared to MDMA.
Yeah, especially from the dopaminergic standpoint of things. And yes, the human versus animal difference is there mechanistically, but the dose makes the poison for pretty much everything. And if you get a similar benefit, or even obviously a better benefit, with macro dose psilocybin or with ketamine or esketamine, then it's going to be more difficult to recommend MDMA. Although I suppose it's possible someone is anaphylactically allergic to psilocybin. Probably not possible for ketamine. If somebody has seen someone that's allergic to ketamine, I've never seen someone that has, and I know ER doctors and anesthesiologists use it all the time.
Yeah, I mean, there could be people who are more sensitive to it, where they get profound dissociation from lower doses, or who would, when they become non-dissociative, they sort of return to full consciousness, that they would be aggressive. But that is probably due to some other confounders, not necessarily the ketamine itself. It's sort of the gauntlet that you're sort of putting together is like the people who want a specific pain medication.
Yes.
People in the audience that are healthcare providers or clinicians probably familiar with, I'm allergic to every one of these except for the one that starts with D, the Dilaudid or Dilala or whatever it's called.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, it's pretty classic. So seeking out this specific medication would certainly happen. Its chance of diversion is quite high. But I suppose you could make a similar case, not as strong, for things like macro doses of psilocybin and to lesser degree ketamine, although I suppose with a high enough dose of all three of these, you would want things to be very closely monitored, because even a licensed therapist, the patient would be at a compromising position. So let's say they fell into a bathtub or a hot tub, they could drown, like Matthew Perry did, especially if they were on other things like buprenorphine or other medications, other CNS depressants.
Yeah, and I think that's part of why they have this sort of built-in requirement to have a long period of supervised therapy or supervision in general. And they said, well, we have this person for 8 hours. Why not just do some therapy while we have them sort of in this state where they need to be medically supervised anyway? Now, it does make a lot of sense. What I was kind of surprised to see was the ratio, slightly more female patients PTSD that enrolled in the trial compared to males. I just sort of associate, PTSD with, military and veterans, mm-hmm. which is predominantly men, not entirely, but certainly the majority are. But, females have a lot of trauma that isn't necessarily war exposure. There's mm-hmm. a lot of trauma, whether it's rape or things like that.
Partner violence.
So that probably accounts for the data there. But it's almost a 50-50 split. It's about 40-60.
Yeah. It would be interesting, not that two groups of 40 people are huge sample sizes, but it would be interesting to see a secondary analysis based on type of trauma, childhood trauma, partner trauma, military trauma, et cetera.
Yeah, it would be what we would call hypothesis generating. It wouldn't be like, oh, it works perfectly for this problem, but it could take the research in that direction if there is a more niche application.
Mm-hmm. So now that we've talked about the study design, it's placebo controlled. Yes, it is a clinical trial. Yes, it has a decent sample size, and it appears that it has good efficacy. So what are the main reasons why people are bringing up why they wouldn't want this to keep on progressing and get FDA approval.
Yeah, and we can flash some of these graphics up so that people can see the sort of differences with placebo versus the MDMA. The good news is everybody got better to some degree, it looks like.
Therapy works, doesn't it?
There were some adverse events that, you know, there's even two cases of suicidal ideation in the placebo group in one of these studies, one attempt. You know, none in the MDMA group, but you can't, with these small numbers, sort of say that it prevents, you know, suicidality or anything like that. But the FDA has several criticisms or sort of concerns about making this an approved medication. So number one is that the patients obviously can tell if they took a placebo pill with just filler or if they took MDMA. There's some pretty apparent effects that people would experience. So that's number one. And I don't know really how you avoid this. Even in most, I'll say, psychotropic drug trials, there's a very strong placebo effect. But as far as getting someone, you know, perhaps an active placebo, so the placebo group we talked about, maybe you pit ketamine against the MDMA and see, you know, ketamine, S-ketamine, as you mentioned, is approved for refractory treatment-resistant depression.
Yes.
Yeah, presumably, we think it could open some neuroplasticity. Combination with therapy would probably be helpful for PTSD as well. So that would give the patient something that they're feeling and also would blind the therapist because they wouldn't sort of know who got what drugs. Mm-hmm. So that's maybe a solution there. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah. One of the things that came to mind is people like to have a apparent effect of any medication or supplement that they take. Benzodiazepines are a good excuse or a good example of an excuse that patients use of why they need that and not something else. I can feel the Xanax working. I can feel the benzodiazepine and everything else does nothing for me. And it is possible that patients would have a similar experience with this, that they could feel this working so well that they do not want anything else in the future. I know that there's some studies that show therapy alone works much worse for patients that have ever taken a benzodiazepine for anxiety. So they could do a follow-up trial of this and then cross over the groups and see if therapy with placebo worked not as well for the patients that had originally got the MDMA.
Yeah, they could do a crossover. At that point, you wonder, you know, 24 hours of therapy time over 3-4 month follow-up period. And it looks like people even improved after that last session until the fourth follow-up point. You'd wonder how much of that benefit was derived, you know, from the initial session without the MDMA. Or are people also going to make the case that, well, MDMA can help out to 6 months, 12 months, 24 months, even though they're not acutely taking the drug over and over again, which was another potential issue that not quite half, so less than half of the patients had taken MDMA outside of a trial setting at some point in the past. So whether this was recreational or whether this was something that, you know, they sought out for therapeutic reasons, we don't really know. We don't know the percentage breakdown from group to group, but a lot of them were familiar with the drug sort of going in, probably why they would sign up for the trial.
Yeah, probably so. And that's going to be hard to avoid because a lot of people who are not familiar with MDMA other than its use as a street drug would specifically not want to sign up for a trial like this. And I wouldn't blame them. The other reason is that patients would and did seek out other treatments, including other psychedelic drugs, for example, ayahuasca or psilocybin, for presumably therapeutic purposes, but perhaps for other purposes as well. It's hard to tell intentions with people between the initial trial and the follow-up, and frankly, after that as well. This is a bit of the slippery slope argument, and the same could be said for opioids, benzos, any medication that can be habit-forming.
Yeah. And you don't know what you're going to get out on the street. So if someone is like, oh, I did MDMA in this trial, it really helped me. Now I don't have access to it because the trial is over. You know, maybe that does prompt some people to go out and seek this. And they may end up with something that has a lot of opiate in it, not necessarily a lot of MDMA in it.
Yes. It reminds me of the article that we wrote with Alec McCarthy and Phil Hollebeck about social trends in PED use. A few of the references that I wrote in one of the later paragraphs talk about what happens when a patient asks to have their testosterone checked. If a male asks you to check his testosterone, it is either 9 or 10 times more likely that he has taken steroids or testosterone in the past, which is pretty crazy to think about. So if a patient asks you, can I get my testosterone checked? Then you need to screen social history for recent and remote PED use without ruining your physician-patient rapport. And the same thing is probably true about patients asking for psychedelic therapies for medication. It doesn't mean that they're going to be a worse candidate for it, but perhaps they need screened to see if they're using things that are not safe outside of clinical contexts.
Yeah, it's almost like taking the patient history is one of the most important roles of patient care.
Yeah, fortunately, a 10-minute doctor visit has plenty of time to do all of that. So your annual Medicare wellness visit will definitely find that.
Yeah. And circling back, the fifth sort of critique the FDA had was how therapists will be trained to, quote, protect people from abuse by clinicians when under the influence of the drug. And I see the concern here, but I don't see how it is relevant because the FDA has not done anything about the pop-up ketamine clinics or telemedicine ketamine clinics or that anyone can get ketamine whenever they want it. Because that's also putting patients in a compromised state, as we alluded to at the beginning of the podcast. So if they're going to be concerned about that in the context of MDMA, they should probably be doing something about that in the context of the widespread ketamine use that's going on.
Yes. There are several ways that they can protect from abuse. One is by limiting the dosing to a place that is supposed to be safe, and that is was supposed to happen with ketamine. Hasn't really turned out that way. Yes, there is very safe places where you can go get IV ketamine or even be supervised when you do a ketamine troche. But as people know, others will use higher doses of ketamine that are intended, including at home, and it can be unsafe. That being said, as long as you don't drown, ketamine is a particularly safe drug by itself. And I suppose from the chance of you dying with a clinical dose of MDMA is relatively low as well, although it is a stimulant. It is still a consideration. But again, really none of these are unique to MDMA. All the same concerns you could have, say, about psilocybin, ketamine, a lot of different drugs.
Yeah, and I think they could quite easily just pivot and make it much more difficult to prescribe. Take Accutane, for example, right? Only certain clinicians can prescribe that.
They have
to be enrolled. You know, there's paperwork involved. It's very difficult to get in. It's not because it's a recreational drug or has diversion value, but it's because they want the health consequences, potentially teratogenic consequences, to be taken very seriously.
It used to be like that for buprenorphine.
Yeah.
You and then the X waiver.
They actually rolled that back with the telemedicine things that are going on. And I think that's probably improved access for a lot of people. I guess something more similar would be Xyrem, which is, yes, I guess, analogous to street GHB. That's something that is also like only certain pharmacies can fill it. Only certain, yes, people can prescribe it because it does have a lot of recreational value. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they've done a nice job of like restricting access to that. Also, the fact that it's like, what, $8,000 a month or something?
It's ridiculous.
That has something to do with it. But they could do the same thing with ketamine quite easily. Just start shutting down compounding pharmacies and pop-up clinics that aren't really screening for true resistant depression and just giving it to people.
Yeah. I suppose with ketamine and esketamine, it relative to any opioid, it is much safer. And relative to really almost any benzo, it's arguably much safer, although in a different ways. And relative to Xyrem and Xywav, it has less abuse potential from a From a euphoria standpoint, I suppose.
So they could at least put, if they wanted to be more aggressive, they could put maybe not the same Xyrem restrictions, but maybe put it on a playing field with opiates for a while and see, are there still instances of this, you know, being abused, even though people are having like monthly visits and refills and certain, I think in some cases clinics will do like only 7 days worth of dispensing, that sort of thing. Yeah.
I think so, in some states to prescribe Accutane or do the iPledge, you have to be a dermatologist. It's state by state. So states also have ability to make some medications more controlled, like Pregnyl, which is HCG, is not federally controlled, but in some states it's harder to get. Same thing for gabapentin, which again kind of has street value, but people don't take it for recreational purposes, I guess. At least
they
not
shouldn't.
Unless they're, yeah, yeah. They shouldn't. It's low down the list.
Yeah, you've hit a pretty low point if you're using it for recreational value. I know I did see a handful of these cases when I was working in the hospital environment, and this was, you know, 5, 6, 7 years ago before it really had caught on. But people would mix it with, you know, alcohol and end up passed out in a ditch somewhere.
Yeah.
These were not kids doing it for fun. These were people who were alcoholics, very high tolerance,
trying
to sort of feel something.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's unfortunate.
Yeah, it is definitely sad. But a decent start would be either a board-certified family medicine doctor or a board-certified psychiatrist. I think that's a good start. And then I suppose board-certified pediatrician, if you have a 16, 17, 18-year-old with really severe PTSD, that would need one of these adjunct medications. I wouldn't be against that either for the right clinician.
Yeah, because you just have to think about, like, if you restricted it to pediatric psychiatrists, there's going to be multi-year long wait list to get in.
Yeah.
Probably the same thing if you restrict it to regular psychiatrists. There's regularly like 3, 6, 12-month wait list to get in with a psychiatrist.
Yeah.
So, you know, you can sort of go different routes, and then you have to just not let it become the Wild West, because then there will be relatively more harm if you're looking at it through that lens. And there's some people that are on the viewpoint of, well, it should just be unrestricted and all drugs should be over the counter. Then you don't have a purity issue. But if you're looking at it through a lens of trying to get more wide approval of these things and further research into this aspect of things, I think that promoting a Wild West approach is not the right way to go in terms of getting the power structures to accept movement in that direction for science.
Mm-hmm. Any step in the right direction is a good step. I think that's a reasonable thing to remember. Frame of reference when it comes to any freedom is very interesting, because some people feel like they have a lot of freedoms in some ways, but they actually don't. And then vice versa is true as well. So the FDA is actually very helpful and very annoying at the same time. But I am glad that we have it. Yes, they're certainly not perfect, especially more so with food than drugs. I think they actually do a really good job doing the clinical trial process and approval process, because they are very lenient in what they allow for clinical trials. They generally aren't shutting down clinical trials right and left, which is nice. But they are about to rule with this, so I guess the three things they could do is they could approve it, they could reject it, and they could request additional info and basically say, maybe let's get more information, which I assume is what's going to happen.
Yeah, I think that from an optics standpoint, that's probably their best move, is to request additional studies or additional info, because if you approve it, then you have contradicted your advisory panel. Great. You're a critical thinker. You looked at the data, saw the outcomes. If you reject it, then you're going to set back this sort of field of research pretty significantly. So I think that option C, additional studies or info, is the most likely scenario. But I guess by the time this is published, we'll know, and people can let us know if we were right or wrong.
Yeah. People can also let us know their personal experience with MDMA or ketamine or psilocybin or any of these other cutting edge therapies for PTSD and other psychiatric conditions. And let us know if we were spot on or spot off in our I guess, praise and criticism of the FDA and their approval or rejection process, and their thoughts on the 200-page neurotoxicity paper. So they can tell us about how, when it's studied in Utah and the LDS community, it's not neurotoxic and whatnot. So educate us about the science there. So as always, we appreciate your time, and we also appreciate both nice and mean comments.
That's true. We actually have a lot of fun reading them. So thank you for your time. Thank you for watching. And may God bless you with health and happiness.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.